Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're glad you're joining us this evening. We always appreciate our customers coming for an event, especially, and it's a delight to welcome Paolo. I told some people I've always wanted to say that. Giardino with Solitude of the Prime Numbers, now translated into 30 languages and winner of many prizes. Also, it's been a film in Italian at the Venice Film Festival in 2010. Yeah, okay. Looks good, too. I saw the preview. Are there subtitles? Okay, so we can watch. Okay. Before writing The Solitude of Prime Numbers, he'd only written short stories, and almost all of them were about children. Definitely the psychological aspects, he said this once in an interview, the ability to show situations and feelings that are no secret and prohibited, that we are usually scared by and ashamed of them. I guess in every novel I search for the humanity that lacks in most of the real relationships. So let's welcome him and hear what he has to say about it.
Thanks. And thanks for being here. You know, before these events in the United States, I'm always scared that there is no one. And so when I see people, I feel it's already been a success. So however it goes. And I'm very happy to be in this bookstore because it's a beautiful bookstore. I wish we still had these kinds of bookstores in Italy, but they're all closing. And because this is not, you get the feeling when you enter this place that it's not only somewhere, it's not only a store, but it's somewhere you can stay and sit down and think. And I mean, it's not for granted, so you should be very, very happy with that. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about my book. Well, not talk about the book, because I'm not really good in doing that, but read some part of it. It's called The Solitude of Prime Numbers, and it's not a book about math. And I will read two sections of it, one bit longer and the other one very short. And then I will leave it to your mercy, to, if you have any sort of personal, political question or whatever comes to your mind, but please don't let me stand alone here all by myself, because still I find that very, very embarrassing. And so just to give you a very brief idea of what the book is about, it's the story of two people, a boy and a girl, which is always a good start, that runs through 30 years, more or less, since they are children until they are in their 30s. And the boy is called Mattia, and the girl's name is Alice, Alice. And, well, I won't tell you anything more beforehand. I'll start reading from, it's not really the beginning of the book, it's the second chapter, where the story of the boy, of Mattia, starts. He's still a child at this point. And This chapter is called The Archimedes Principle, which all of you know, of course. And it's set in 1984. When the twins were small, and Michela was up to one of her tricks, like throwing herself downstairs in her baby walker, or sticking a pea up one of her nostrils so that she had to be taken to the emergency room to have it removed with special tweezers, their father would always say to Mattia, the firstborn, that his mother's womb was too small for both of them. "God only knows what the two of you got up to in there," he said. "I reckon all those kicks you gave your sister did her some serious damage." Then he laughed, even though it was no laughing matter. He lifted Michela in the air and buried his beard in her soft cheeks. Mattia would watch from below. He would laugh too, letting his father's words filter through him by osmosis, without really understanding them. He let them settle at the bottom of his stomach, forming a thick, sticky layer. His father's laughter turned into a strained smile when at 2.5, Michela still couldn't utter a single word. Not even mommy, or poo-poo, or sleepy, or woof. Her inarticulate little cries rose from such a solitary, deserted place that they made their father shiver every time. When she was 5.5, a speech therapist with thick glasses set Michela down in front of a board with 4 different shapes cut out: a star, a circle, a square, and a triangle, and the corresponding color pieces to place into the holes. Michela looked at them with wonder. "Where does the star go, Michela?" asked the speech therapist. Michela stared at the puzzle, but didn't touch anything. The doctor put the yellow star in her hand. "Where does this go, Michela?" she asked. Michela looked everywhere and nowhere. She put one of the points in her mouth and began to chew on it. The speech therapist took the object out of her mouth and asked the question yet again. "Michela, do what the doctor tells you, for God's sake," said her father, who couldn't quite manage to stay seated, as he'd been told. "Mr. Balossino, please," the doctor said. "Children need time." So Michela took her time, a whole minute. Then she let out a heart-rending groan that might have been of joy or of despair, and resolutely jammed the star in the squared hole. In case Mattia had not already figured out for himself that something was not right with his sister, his classmates didn't hesitate to point it out to him. Simona Volterra, for example, during the first year at school. When the teacher said, "Simona, you're going to sit next to Michela this month," she refused, crossing her arms, and said, "I don't want to sit next to her." Mattia let Simona and the teacher argue for a while, and then said, "Miss, I can sit next to Michela again." Everyone had looked relieved. Michela, Simona, the teacher, everyone except Mattia. The twins sat in the front row. Michela spent the whole day coloring, meticulously going outside the lines and picking colors at random. Blue children, red skies, all the trees yellow. She gripped the pencil like a meat pounder, pressing down so hard that she often tore the page. At her side, Mattia learned to read and write, to add and subtract, and was the first in the class to master long division. His brain seemed to be a perfect machine, in the same mysterious way that his sister's was so defective. Sometimes Michela would start screaming on the chair, waving her arms around crazily like a trapped moth. Her eyes would grow dark, and the teacher, more frightened than she was, would stand and look at her, vaguely hoping that the retard really might fly away one day. Someone in the back row would giggle, someone else would go shh. So Mattia would get up, picking up his chair so that it wouldn't scrape on the floor, and stand behind Michela, who by now was rolling her head from side to side and flailing her arms about so fast that he was afraid they would come off. Mattia would take her hands and delicately wrap her arms around her chest. "There, you don't have wings anymore," he'd whisper in her ear. It took Michela a few seconds before she stopped trembling. She'd stare into the distance for a few seconds, and then go back to tormenting her drawings as if nothing had happened. Mattia would sit back down, head lowered and ears red with embarrassment, and the teacher would go on with the lesson. In the third year of primary school, the twins still hadn't been invited to any of their classmates' birthday parties. Their mother noticed and thought she could solve the issue by throwing the twins a birthday party. At dinner, Mr. Balossino had rejected the suggestion out of hand. "For heaven's sake, Adele, it's already embarrassing enough as it is." Mattia sighed with relief, and Michela dropped her fork for the 10th time. It was never mentioned again. Then, one morning in January, Riccardo Pelotti came over to Mattia's desk. "Hey, my mom says you can come to my birthday party," he said, looking at the blackboard. "So can she," he added, pointing to Michela, who was carefully smoothing the surface of the desk as if it were a bed sheet. Mattia's face went red with excitement. He said thank you, but Riccardo, having gotten the weight off his chest, had already left. The twins' mother immediately became anxious and took them both to Benetton for new clothes. They went to three toy shops, but Adele couldn't make up her mind. "What sort of things is Riccardo interested in? Would he like this?" she asked Mattia, holding up a jigsaw puzzle. "How would I know?" "He's a friend of yours. You must know what games he likes." Mattia didn't think that Riccardo was a friend of his, but he couldn't explain that to his mother, so he simply shrugged. In the end, Adele opted for the Lego spaceship, the biggest and most expensive toy in the store. "Mom, it's too much." "Nonsense. And besides, there are two of you. You don't want to make a bad impression." Mattia knew all too well that, Lego or no Lego, they would make a bad impression. With Michela, anything else was impossible. He knew that Riccardo had invited them only because he'd been told to. Michela would cling to him the whole time, spill orange juice on herself, and then start whining, as she always did when she was tired. For the first time, Mattia thought it might be better to stay at home. Or rather, he thought it might be better if Michela stayed at home. "Mom," he began uncertainly. Adele was looking in the bag for the wallet. "Yes?" Mattia took a breath. "Does Michela really have to come to the party?" Adele suddenly froze and stared into her son's eyes. The cashier observed the scene indifferently, her hand open waiting for the money. Michela was mixing up the candy on the rack. Mattia's cheeks burned, ready to receive a slap that never came. "Of course she's coming," his mother said, and that was that. Riccardo's house was less than a 10-minute walk away, and they were allowed to go on their own. At 3 o'clock on the dot, Adele pushed the twins out the door. "Go on, or you'll be late. Remember to thank his parents," she said. Then she turned to Mattia. "Take care of your sister. You know she shouldn't eat junk." Mattia nodded. Adele kissed them both on the cheek, Michela for longer. She tied in Michela's hair under her hairband and said, "Enjoy yourselves." On the way to Riccardo's house, Mattia's thoughts kept time with the Lego pieces, which shifted back and forth inside the box like the tide. Michela, taking a few feet behind him, stumbled as she tried to keep up, dragging her feet through the mush of dead leaves stuck to the pavement. The air was still and cold. "She's going to drop her potato chips on the rug," thought Mattia. "She'll grab the ball and she won't want to give it back." "Will you hurry up?" he said, turning to his twin sister, who had suddenly crouched down in the middle of the pavement and was torturing a long worm with her finger. Michela looked at her brother, as if seeing him for the first time in ages. She smiled and ran to him, clutching the worm between her fingers. "You're disgusting. Throw it away," Mattia said, recoiling. Michela looked at the worm again for a moment and seemed to be wondering how it had ended up in her hand. Then she dropped it and launched into a lopsided run to join her brother, who had already walked on ahead. "She grabbed the ball and won't want to give it back, just like at school," he thought to himself. Mattia looked at his twin, who had his same eyes, same nose, same color hair, and a brain that belonged in the trash. And for the first time, he felt genuine hatred. He took her hand to cross the street because the cars were going fast, and it was then that the idea came to him. He let go of Michela's hand in its woolen glove, instantly thinking that it wasn't right. Then, as they were walking by the park, he changed his mind again and convinced himself that no one would ever find out. "Just for a few hours," he thought. "Just this once." He changed direction, dragging Michela by an arm, and entered the park. The grass was still damp from the night's frost. Michela trotted behind him, muddying her brand new white suit boots. There was no one in the park. It was so cold that no one would have felt like going for a walk. The twins came to an area with trees, three wooden tables, and a barbecue. They had eaten lunch there once, in year one, when the teachers had taken them to collect dry leaves from which they made ugly table decorations to give to their grandparents for Christmas. "Michela, listen to me," said Mattia. "Are you listening?" With Michela, you always had to check that her narrow channel of communication was open. Mattia waited for his sister to nod. "Good. So I have to go away for a little while, okay? But I won't be long, just half an hour." There was no reason to tell the truth, since to Michela there was little difference between half an hour and a whole day. The doctor had said that her spatiotemporal perception development had been arrested at a preconscious stage, and Mattia understood perfectly well what that meant. "You sit here and wait for me," he said to his twin. Michela stared gravely at her brother and didn't reply, because she didn't know how to reply. She gave no sign of having really understood, but her eyes lit up for a moment. And for the rest of his life, when Mattia thought of those eyes, he thought of fear. He took a few steps away from his sister, walking backward to make sure she didn't follow him. "Only prawns walk like that," his mother had yelled at him once, "and they always end up crashing into something." He was about 15 yards away, and Michela had already stopped looking at him, engrossed in trying to pull a button off her woolen coat. Mattia turned around and started to run, tightly clutching the bag with the present. Inside the box, more than 200 little plastic blocks crashed into one another, and it was as if they were trying to tell him something. Thank you. So, this is how it starts for him. And of course, I haven't read the rest of the chapter. And there is a sort of parallel story for Alicia, for the girl, which actually I was willing to read today because it's about snow and skiing, and since we are here and mountains are so, because yesterday I was like in the Orange County and it sounded a bit weird to read about snow, but here it would make some sense. But I don't know why that chapter is very hard for me to read in English loud, and so I try to skip it. But if you read it, the book starts with a day of ski, and I presume many of you do ski and did when they were children. And I don't know how it was for you. Maybe it's easier here that you get sunshine in the winter, but in Italy, and for me, it was really a torture. It was the thing that I most hated in my whole life. You know, this getting up early, getting dressed with all this heavy stuff and the boots, and then going out in the cold. And my key school mates who were all, I'm sorry to say, but they were all assholes. Yes, I don't know why. They were really, really mean. And so that was a nightmare. And and that explains a little bit the mechanism out of which I wrote this book, because every single chapter can be somehow traced back to something I was afraid of when I was either a child or a teenager. And the book itself really, really comes out of fear. Probably you had that feeling also from the part that I read. For example, that short story of Mattia and his sister came out of a very small image that my mother gave to me. She was a teacher. Well, she's a teacher. And she used to work a lot with special need children. And one day she told me of one of these of our kid was doing. Suddenly, in the middle of a lesson, she would stand up and start waving the arms and scream. And when she told me this story, I was really somehow shocked by it. And I kept it for many years in my mind. And then when I started writing this novel, I just went back to that single image and I made the whole chapter out of that detail. And again, it was about fear. Because as a child, I was really scared when I saw like children like me who had some sort of disability. How do you say that? And I had a neighbor same age of me who had a problem like that, and I was really scared by looking at them. And at the same time, since my mother did that job, I knew exactly that I had not to be scared. So this built very very difficult contradiction. So being scared, knowing at the same time that you shouldn't be, and so feeling guilty because you're scared. I think that's a loop that we experience in many things when we are children. Well, also when we are adults, but then you become able to break it somehow. But when you're a child, you're really taken into this loop of fear and sense of guilty, and it all becomes very, very complicated. And that's one of the things that run throughout the book, I think. So, before leaving space to you, I just wanted to read this very last page, which is in the middle of the book. Now, both Mattia and Alice are in their 20s, and they have met each other at high school, and they've started this sort of very deep friendship that tries to become something more, but both of them, since they are a little bit troubled, they kind of escape this love affair. So they circle around each other. And this page explains, I think, the title. It's the page where this metaphor of the prime numbers is used. So it's the only, one and only mathematical page in the book. And the reason why there is this, prime numbers are there, is that Mattia becomes, at some point, he decides to study maths, to take math at college. So, like most mathematicians and physicists, I should say, like I am or have been, he's really weird, and he's obsessed by numbers, and prime numbers in particular are something that obsesses a lot me and my colleagues. I remember a time when I was every day was sitting on the bus and writing down prime numbers, and because I was trying to solve the big problem, and people would look at me in this comforting way. So I transferred this obsession to the character, and that's how it goes. It's page 111. Which is not a prime number, by the way. Just prime numbers are divisible only by one and by themselves. They hold their place in the infinite series of natural numbers, squashed like all numbers between two others, but one step further than the rest. They are suspicious and solitary, which is why Mattia thought they were wonderful. Sometimes he thought that they had ended up in that sequence by mistake, that they'd been trapped like pearls strung on a necklace. Other times he suspected that they too would have preferred to be like all the others, just ordinary numbers, but for some reason they couldn't do it. The second thought struck him mostly at night, in the chaotic interweaving of images that comes before sleep, when the mind is too weak to tell itself lies. In his first year at university, Mattia had learned that among prime numbers, there are some that are even more special. Mathematicians call them twin primes, pairs of prime numbers that are close to each other, almost neighbors. But between them, there is always an even number that prevents them from truly touching. Numbers like 11 and 13, like 17 and 19, 41 and 43. If you have the patience to go on counting, you discover that these pairs gradually become rarer. You encounter increasingly isolated primes, lost in that silent, measured space made only of ciphers, and you develop a distressing presentiment that the pairs encountered up until that point were accidental, that solitude is the true destiny. Then, just when you're about to surrender, when you no longer have the desire to go on counting, you come across another pair of twins, clutching each other tightly. There is a common conviction among mathematicians that however far you go, there will always be another two, even if no one can say where exactly, until they are discovered. Mattia thought that he and Alice were like that, twin primes, alone and lost. Close, but not close enough to really touch each other. He had never told her that. When he imagined confessing these things to her, the thin layer of sweat on his hands evaporated completely, and for a good 10 minutes he was no longer capable of touching anything. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.